Today is Saturday, November 23rd, and this is the World Socialist website. U.S. threats against the International Criminal Court and the normalization of genocide, by Andre Damon. On Thursday, the International Criminal Court, ICC, formally issued warrants for the arrest of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Defense Minister Yoav Gallant for war crimes and crimes against humanity. The action is a testament to the criminality of the war of extermination waged by Israel against the people of Gaza, with the support of the U.S. and other imperialist powers, which has led to the deaths of at least 42,000 and as many as 183,000 people in Gaza. More than 90% of the pre-invasion population of Gaza has been internally displaced. The entire population has been subjected to severe shortages of food and water, and the majority of houses, schools, hospitals, and universities have been either damaged or destroyed. The court charged Netanyahu and Gallant with the, quote, war crime of starvation as a method of warfare, end quote, and the crimes against humanity of murder, persecution, and other inhumane acts. The ruling vindicates the mass protests carried out by millions all over the world against the Gaza genocide, which the imperialist governments have falsely denounced as being motivated by anti-Semitism. Netanyahu's guilt is imperialism's guilt. The entire American political establishment, from the Biden administration and the Democratic Party to the Republican Party and the incoming Trump administration, has supported the genocide and has united in condemning the ICC decision. In a statement on Thursday, U.S. Senator Tom Cotton made threats to wage war against countries or even assassinate leaders who cooperate with the ICC case, while Senator Lindsey Graham has led a bipartisan group of senators pushing for the U.S. to sanction the International Criminal Court. The White House expressed its openness to calls for sanctioning the ICC. President Joe Biden responded to the warrants with an open endorsement of Israel's war against the population of Gaza, declaring, quote, whatever the ICC might imply, there is no equivalence, none, between Israel and Hamas. We will always stand with Israel against threats to its security, end quote. There is, in fact, no equivalence. The Palestinians are an oppressed people who have been subjected to decades of occupation at the hands of Israel, confined to open-air prisons, and denied the most basic democratic rights. And Israel is a massively armed state financed by imperialism, carrying out a genocide against a population it illegally occupies. American officials are well aware that the charges brought by the ICC do not only condemn Israel. It is a well-established legal principle that those who finance, direct, and authorize a crime are culpable in its commission. To the extent that U.S. officials have bothered to give rationalizations for their attack on the ICC's case against Netanyahu, it has been to declare, in the words of White House spokesperson Karine Jean-Pierre, that the, quote, ICC does not have jurisdiction over this matter, end quote. This is a fraud. The International Court of Justice ruled definitively this year that the Israeli occupation of Palestine is illegal, and the International Criminal Court likewise ruled that it has standing to bring charges against Israeli leaders for crimes committed in Palestine. The Gaza genocide is part of a global eruption of imperialist war, centrally targeting Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, aimed at the total subjugation of the former colonial world to the imperialist powers. The lead essay in the latest edition of Foreign Affairs asserts, an era of limited war has ended, an age of comprehensive conflict has begun. Indeed, what the world is witnessing today is akin to what theorists in the past have called total war, in which combatants draw on vast resources, mobilize their societies, prioritize warfare over all other state activities, attack a broad variety of targets, and reshape their economies and those of other countries. To declare that this new era of global warfare allows countries to, quote, attack a broad variety of targets, end quote, is a colloquial way of saying that international law is being suspended and civilians, hospitals, and humanitarian organizations are all targets. This Israeli model is to be the standard for waging war in the future by imperialist powers. The vicious response by the U.S. to the ICC's charging of Netanyahu takes place just days after Biden and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer authorized the launching of NATO long-range missiles deep inside Russia. Despite threats from Russia to retaliate to attacks on its territory with the use of nuclear weapons. The sponsorship by the imperialist powers of the Gaza genocide is a warning. They are prepared to accept the deaths of countless numbers of people, both those of their adversaries and of their own citizens, to achieve their geopolitical aims. The damage that tens of thousands of Israeli bombings have done over more than a year, equivalent to two Hiroshima-sized nuclear bombs, can be done in an instant with a modern nuclear weapon. In asserting that it will not enforce the ICC's arrest warrant, the German government declared, quote, "It is a consequence of German history that we share unique relations and great responsibility with Israel," end quote. The Telegraph translated this statement more colloquially by declaring, quote, "Germany won't arrest Netanyahu because of its Nazi history," end quote. This is true, but not in the way that the Telegraph means it. Israel is waging, although at a smaller scale, the type of war of extermination waged by Nazi Germany against the Soviet Union. This method of war will more and more become the norm in the global wars waged by the imperialist powers. In its 2024 New Year's statement, the World Socialist website editorial board made the following warning. All the red lines that demarcate civilization from barbarism are being effaced. The motto of capitalist governments is, "Nothing that is criminal is alien to us." Nuclear war is being normalized. Genocide is being normalized. Pandemics and the deliberate culling of the infirm and elderly have been normalized. Unfathomable levels of wealth concentration and social inequality have been normalized. The suppression of democracy and the resort to authoritarianism and fascism are being normalized. The crimes of Nazi Germany, condemned as aberrations by capitalist governments of the past, are being more and more accepted as the model and the conduct of imperialist foreign policy. In their response to the ICC's charges against Netanyahu, the imperialist powers have made clear that they intend to continue funding and arming the Gaza genocide and shield its persecutors from accountability. It is made clear that the fight to end the genocide is necessarily a fight to abolish imperialism, and that this requires the development of a mass movement in the working class. Stop Starmer's escalating war against Russia. Build the Socialist Anti-War Movement by Chris Marsden. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer's Labour government has dragged Britain to the point of an all-out war with Russia with devastating consequences. By agreeing to Ukraine firing Storm Shadow cruise missiles into Russian territory, he has made a de facto declaration of war without so much as a debate in Parliament. His defense secretary, John Healey, had the gall to tell Parliament's defense committee that, quote, "In the end, the only one that benefits from such a public debate is President Putin," end quote. Labor can refuse a public discussion on a war for which there is no popular support because Parliament is a cesspit populated by MPs who function as a single party of war determined to pursue British imperialism's predatory interest, even at the risk of nuclear conflict. In the aftermath of President Biden's authorizing U.S. missile attacks by Ukraine that led to the use of ATACMS Tuesday and an unconfirmed number of U.K. Shadow Storm missiles fired into Kursk Wednesday, President Vladimir Putin made clear Russia views this as the direct participation of the U.S. and Britain in a war against Russia. In a televised address Thursday, he specifically warned of an attack on U.S. and U.K. military assets. Quote, "We have the right to use our weapons against military facilities of those countries which allow their weapons to be used on our facilities. And in case of escalation of aggressive actions, we will respond resolutely in a mirror way," end quote. Putin confirmed Russia's firing of a, quote, "non-nuclear hypersonic version of a ballistic missile," end quote, that hit a Ukrainian missile and armaments complex in the city of Dnipropetrovsk. The new missile was chosen because its payload is exclusively associated with nuclear-capable missiles and because, Putin asserted, quote, "there are currently no ways of counteracting this weapon." The missiles attack targets at a speed of 10 Mach, that's 2.5 to 3 kilometers per second, end quote. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova has denounced a U.S. missile base in Poland at Rzeczykowo as a, quote, "priority target for potential destruction," end quote. But Russia's retaliatory threat is much wider. U.S. officials said that an intermediate-range ballistic missile, IRBM, has a range of 3,000 to 5,500 kilometers, 1,860 to 3,415 miles, making the whole of Europe and Britain a potential target. To this, Britain's government and opposition parties united behind one demand: escalate the war. Starmer told Parliament on Thursday, quote, "We will not be deterred or distracted by reckless threats. We will back Ukraine with what is needed for as long as it is needed," end quote. He praised Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch for supporting him, welcoming, quote, "the continued unity across the House. If we divide on the issue, the only winner will be Putin, and I am not prepared to let that happen," end quote. The same response came from the armed forces. Rob McGowan, deputy chief of the British Defence Staff, told Parliament's Defence Committee, quote, "If the British Army was asked to fight tonight, it would fight tonight. I don't think anybody in this room should be under any illusion that if the Russians invaded Eastern Europe tonight, then we would meet them in that fight," end quote. The expelled former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn politely asked Starmer, quote, "What pathway does he see to bringing about a cessation," end quote, of the conflict. On X, Twitter, he demanded that Starmer make a statement confirming whether UK missiles have been fired into Russia and, quote, "tell the British public, if this means we are now at war with a nuclear power, what risks this poses to the people in Britain and why this action was taken without any approval from Parliament," end quote. But he failed to make these demands in Westminster, and no one else did either. Corbyn does not even speak for the whole of the socialist campaign group he once led in opposing war against Russia. His former shadow chancellor, John McDonnell, leads several members of the group who have long demanded the stepping up of UK arms supplies to Ukraine, not an end to the conflict, and who have now had their wishes granted. Corbyn's refusal to drive the Blairites out of the Labour Party is primarily responsible for putting the vile warmonger Starmer in number 10. Moreover, he heads the Stop the War coalition, which has all but ignored the Ukraine war and its dangers for over a year, and which has walled off the millions who have protested the Gaza genocide from a broader struggle against the imperialist-backed war. The Stop the War coalition has made a pro forma protest against Starmer and Biden, quote, for delaying possible diplomatic solutions, end quote, and, quote, taking us to the edge of a wider war between nuclear-armed great powers, end quote. But as with its constant appeals for the British government to back a ceasefire in Gaza, Stop the War ends with a pathetic call for, quote, Starmer and Biden to stop these provocations immediately and to focus on securing a negotiated end to the war, end quote. The escalation of the conflict in Russia and Ukraine takes place amid rising threats of the Gaza genocide and attacks on Lebanon and Syria becoming a full-blown war with Iran, and rising tensions with North Korea, at least nominally targeted in Kursk, and with China. The global spread of war is rooted in a deepening crisis of world capitalism that drives the imperialist powers to a struggle for global hegemony, which has already claimed hundreds of thousands of lives in Ukraine and led to mass murder and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. In the fight against this, the future of humanity is at stake. Stop the War and the pseudo-left and Stalinist tendencies that make up the coalition oppose the revolutionary mobilization of the working class internationally that alone can bring the end to the war. The same conditions giving rise to war drive the ruling class into ever more direct and brutal conflict with workers who must be made to pay for it. But everything depends on the struggles that will erupt against militarism, austerity, and right-wing reaction being armed with a socialist and internationalist perspective and leadership. A year of mass protests against the murderous assault by Israel on the Palestinians, with the active backing of London, Washington, Berlin, and Paris, that confined workers and young people to pressure, quote-unquote, on the streets, for a reversal of government policy, drove them into a political dead end. The Tories have been replaced by a Labour government equally committed to genocide and now working in unison for a war against Russia, whose consequences are yet more devastating. The Socialist Equality Party and our comrades in the International Committee of the Fourth International call for the building of a socialist anti-war movement based on the international working class, the great revolutionary force in society. This must be waged as a political offensive by workers against British imperialism and its labor government, and in defiance of trade union leaders who support NATO, genocide, and war, just as surely as does Starmer. They systematically sabotage and betray every development of the class struggle that threatens to cut across the drive to subordinate social and economic life to the dictates of trade and military war. A rank-and-file rebellion of workers is required, combining a struggle in defense of living standards with a political struggle against imperialism. This is inseparable from the resolute defense of social and democratic rights, because the ruling class cannot wage war abroad, nor impose the vast attacks on jobs, wages, and essential services this demands by democratic means. This is why opposition to war is being criminalized everywhere, including in Ukraine, where Trotskyist youth leader Bogdan Syrtyuk was arrested because he fought to unify workers in Russia and Ukraine against the conflict. Workers must understand that the fight against war is a fight against capitalism and for socialism, requiring a struggle to put an end to the dictatorship of finance capital and the capitalist economic system. The Socialist Equality Party urges all those workers and young people who recognize this fundamental truth to join this party. Sri Lankan president announces JVP-NPP government will implement savage IMF austerity program in full. By Saman Gunadasa and Keith Jones. Sri Lanka's newly elected Janata Vimukti Peramuna, National People's Power, JVP-NPP government, has jettisoned its election pledge to renegotiate the country's bailout agreement with the IMF, International Monetary Fund, claiming to protect the most vulnerable. Sri Lanka's president, JVP-NPP leader, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, used his speech inaugurating the 10th session of the country's parliament to announce that his government will implement the savage austerity program demanded by the IMF in full. Dissanayake claimed that any reopening of the $2.9 billion three-year bailout agreement with the IMF, as well as associated agreements with global investors and governments on the repayment of bond debt, would place the economy at grave risk. Dissanayake said, quote, "Due to the scale of the crisis, even the smallest error could have significant repercussions. There is no room for mistakes." End quote. Rather, the government's focus would be on, quote, "ensuring economic stability and reaffirming trust with the relevant economic stakeholders," end quote, that is, Sri Lankan and global capital. Dissanayake then tried to justify the imposition of further punitive increases in taxes and electricity rates, massive cuts to vital public services, the fire sale of public sector assets, and the destruction of hundreds of thousands of jobs by claiming there is no alternative. Quote, "Debating whether the proposed restructuring plan is good or bad, advantageous or disadvantageous, serves no purpose," end quote, declared the JVP-NPP president. Quote, "This is the reality we are faced with," end quote. Underscoring that the government now intends to rapidly move forward with implementing the further austerity measures stipulated in the IMF bailout agreement, Dissanayake said he expects to have reached a quote-unquote staff-level agreement with the IMF by Saturday. Under that agreement, Colombo is expected to generate a 2.8% primary budgetary surplus in the coming year through a combination of budget cuts and revenue-raising measures. The government is also committed, starting in 2028, to repay Sri Lanka's creditors an estimated $5 billion per year, an amount that exceeds 5% of the country's current GDP. Thursday's reopening of parliament came exactly 1 week after the JVP-NPP swept the polls, winning 159 of the 225 seats in parliament. By exploiting mass anger and disaffection with the traditional political establishment and the handful of elite capitalist families that have always dominated, these parties have presided over a devastating socio-economic crisis since 2022, one, moreover, that erupted after years of austerity and increasing economic insecurity and social inequality. Dissanayake, who was catapulted into the presidency in last September's presidential poll, immediately called new parliamentary elections, arguing that he needed a quote-unquote strong mandate to fight corruption and bring about a, quote, national economic renaissance, end quote. In response, the Socialist Equality Party of Sri Lanka and the World Socialist website warned the working class and oppressed toilers not to be fooled by the JVP-NPP's demagogy and by the attempts of the Sri Lankan and international media to dress up this right-wing, pro-imperialist, Sinhala chauvinist party as left or even socialist. We specifically warned that Dissanayake would quickly drop his calls for modifications to the IMF agreement and that any changes would prove at most to be cosmetic. Quote, JVP-NPP leaders sometimes declared they would renegotiate the hated IMF program. This is purely to hoodwink workers and the poor who are bitterly opposed to the austerity measures that have made deep inroads into living conditions through increased prices for essentials, tariffs, and the near collapse of the public health service, end quote. We further warned that Dissanayake had postponed negotiations with the IMF on the release of the third loan installment, so as to get the election out of the way and strengthen the JVP-NPP's hand in Parliament before imposing the IMF's diktats in the face of what will be mounting and increasingly explosive social opposition. All these warnings have borne out, and on the very first day, the majority JVP-NPP Parliament was convened. The IMF diktats for increased austerity and the restructure of Sri Lankan capitalism to produce bigger investor profits will determine the government's agenda from top to bottom. Dissanayake tried, however, to obscure this with flowery pledges of democracy, national harmony, and a transformational government that will be focused on the well-being of the people. The president even claimed the government would increase support for the poor. All of this was subterfuge. The JVP-NPP government has declared its true colors. For all its phony left-progressive posturing, it is a government beholden to Sri Lankan and international capital that will ruthlessly impose their diktats on working people. The JVP's talk of democracy is utterly fraudulent, and not just because it transparently lied to the population, claiming it would find a way to change the IMF bailout agreement to lessen mass suffering. The IMF program is the distillation of the dictatorship of the global financial oligarchy and their Sri Lankan capitalist clients. Its imposition will mark an enormous social regression that will be measured in increased poverty, hunger, and declining life expectancy, as has already unfolded since 2021. Dissanayake tried to shift blame for the program his government will now implement onto its predecessor. He noted that the previous president, Ranil Wickremesinghe, had conducted debt restructuring agreements just 2 days before the September 21st presidential election. But this only underscores their entirely illegitimate character. The reality is that all agreements the JVP-NPP insist cannot be changed are the outcome of a conspiracy against the people. Wickremesinghe, then the sole parliamentarian of the right-wing United National Party, was undemocratically imposed as the country's president in July 2022 after a mass popular uprising had chased President Gotabaya Rajapaksa from power. The JVP played its part in this conspiracy, working with the opposition Samaji Janabalawagaya and the trade unions to divert the uprising into cause for a new capitalist government based on the parliamentary opposition. Then, when the rump parliament elected Wickremesinghe as president, the JVP supported his turn to the IMF and used its affiliated unions to channel mounting working-class opposition to the initial impact of the IMF austerity measures into impotent calls for the government to change course or provide relief. That Dissanayake's almost 7,000-word address said nothing about the NATO-instigated war against Russia over Ukraine, the imperialist-backed Israeli genocide against the Palestinians, the U.S. military strategic offensive against China, or for that matter any foreign policy issue, does not mean that the ever-intensifying global geopolitical crisis will not be a preoccupation for the new government. Just as it is continuing Wickremesinghe's IMF scorched earth program, so the new government has signaled that it will continue to integrate Sri Lanka ever more fully into the US-led, Indian-supported plans for war with China. What Dissanayake did mention, albeit from the standpoint of the economic potential of the Port of Colombo, was Sri Lanka's unique position as a hub in the Indian Ocean, which is a key arena in the U.S. drive to secure hegemony over the Indo-Pacific and Eurasia. Arguably, the most cynical element of Dissanayake's lie-laden speech was his attempt to promote his JVP-NPP government as a resolute opponent of racism and communalism and a votary of national harmony. In the opening passages of his speech, the president referred to the unprecedented vote his party has obtained across the country, including in the predominantly Tamil North and the East. He deplored that in the past, politics had often been shaped, quote, along regional, ethnic, or religious lines, end quote, leading to, quote, suspicion and mistrust, end quote. He vowed his government will, quote, not allow a resurgence of divisive racist politics in this country, end quote. None of this is to be believed. Indeed, given the JVP's history and class character, Dissanayake's proclamation that the government will never allow a resurgence of racist politics should be construed as a threat that it will condemn opposition from the Tamil minority as divisive and intolerable. The reality is, Dissanayake's discussion of Sri Lanka's tragic history, including the almost three-decade-long anti-Tamil war, was entirely abstract. There was not even a single reference to a government, a party, a political leader, or policy. Its aim was very much to absolve the Sinhala capitalist elite and its state for their responsibility in whipping up anti-Tamil chauvinism, to divide the working class, and to excuse and cover up the role of the JVP, which throughout its six-decade history has played an especially pernicious role in anti-Tamil incitement. To this day, Dissanayake and the JVP celebrates the fascistic rebellion it mounted in 1988 to 1989 against the Indo-Sri Lanka Accord. Today, the JVP-NPP is trying to present itself as the foremost promoter of Sri Lankan nationalism, but this quote-unquote nationalism is inextricably entwined with Sinhala Buddhist supremacism. Workers must be warned. When opposition to the government erupts, the JVP will, as the ruling class has always done, seek to whip up communal divisions so as to split the working class and embolden reaction. The Dissanayake JVP-NPP government is one of extreme crisis. There is an explosive gap between the popular expectations of the government and the class war agenda it is now moving to implement. The JVP leaders are themselves aware that the ruling class has very much turned to them as a last line of defense for the bourgeois order before risking a resort to military rule. Government spokesman and JVP General Secretary Tilvin Silva recently told a press conference, quote, "The people have given us this huge win because they believed in us. But if we don't hold on to the weight of that responsibility and we fail, then there is no one else to come to the rescue," end quote. The JVP-NPP will try to use its unprecedented parliamentary majority to claim that all opposition to its attacks is anti-democratic. There is also no question that it will make use of the powers of the executive presidency and the battery of anti-democratic and emergency laws adopted by predecessor governments to criminalize and try to violently suppress an insurgent movement of the working class. A recurring theme in all Dissanayake's address is the need to establish, quote, law and order, end quote, as a prerequisite for economic revival. The SEP intervened in the just-concluded parliamentary elections to bring to the working class the revolutionary socialist program on which it must base its opposition to the JVP-NPP government, and to organize the most advanced workers and youth in our ranks so as to provide programmatic, tactical, and organizational leadership in the struggles that will soon erupt. Sri Lanka's workers and toilers must unequivocally reject the demands of the government, and behind them the ruling class, that they pay for the crisis of capitalism. To oppose the dismantling of public services, privatization, and the assault on their democratic and social rights, working people must form workplace and neighborhood action committees independent of the pro-capitalist trade unions. In opposition to the capitalist parliament and the entire structure of capitalist class rule, the SEP fights for a democratic and socialist congress of workers and rural masses made up of democratically elected representatives from the growing network of action committees. Such a congress must advocate for and build an independent political movement of the working class with an internationalist perspective, rallying the rural poor against the bourgeoisie and to fight for the establishment of a workers' and peasants' government to implement a socialist program. For these articles and more, please visit the World Socialist website at www.wsws.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Jesse Thomas.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.